Welcome to Active Heart, episode 3.
Hey.
We're back. Here to talk about episode 3, which is mostly just a bummer. This episode is rough.
Yeah. So,
it's rougher than I remember it being.
The very first part of this episode, I feel like we have to take, you have to take part of it, and I have to take part of it, and you have to take the part of it that scrolls by quickly in Japanese.
Well, I can't. So this episode begins very, there's a cold open, and the cold open is just this scrolling Japanese text that is a short technical layman's explanation of how faster than light travel warp works in the Gunbuster universe. And it scrolls up and up over the course of about 30 seconds or so. And then at the bottom, there's a tag that, like a attribution line that makes it clear that it's from a presentation that Kazumi Amano gave at a science fair or a high level high school student science presentation. But on top of that, something in the audio, something else is happening.
Something else entirely. So we left off the last episode with Noriko running out of the room, but it was the middle of the Excellium launch party.
Right.
So we have this voice that comes in. I think the captain, he's like, now, the part of the Excellium launch party you've all been waiting
TK,
for.
Buddy, no, you can't do that.
Our cat is being really in the way.
He just rammed right into the table and making a big old noise that I'm sure you heard.
You might have heard that meow too. Anyway, it's like, what you've all been waiting for, a duet between Kazumi Amano and Koichiro Ota with the air of forbidden love. And then they sang an Enka duet called A Man and a Woman's Love Game.
Yes.
And one of the lines from this song that they're singing is, whiskey, casual love, old pains, a man and a woman's love. And they're very into it, and it's, I don't know, this opening is just a great piece of comedy.
Yes.
But it's also funny to me because this is way more, we get the sense it's going there, but this is way more than we've actually been shown textually.
Yes.
About their feelings for each other.
Yeah. Also, I love that it turns out that Koichi is always referred to only by his name, Koichi, coach.
Koichi.
But his first name is actually Koichiro. So Koichi is a funny nickname for that. It's cute.
There's also a cat just howling outside of our window.
You know what? It's New York City, baby. What are you going to do?
Right. Okay. Then the episode actually starts. And Noriko is narrating a letter that she's writing to her best friend, Kimiko, who's back on Earth. And the music is very wistful.
Right.
And it has the tone of a very, once again, I have to go there. It reminds me of Nanako's letters to her brother.
Oh, wow. I hadn't even thought of that. But it very, it very much
always,
is.
Excitable but contemplative.
Yes.
And she's talking about her daily life on the ship, but she's also explaining Paul's always gonna have to come in and fine-tune whatever science shit I say.
I mean,
she's explaining,
it's not like it's real science shit.
They go into subspace.
Yeah. She's explaining how they travel and the fact that they're not always, doing faster than light travel. They can only do faster than light travel in areas where space is very flat, which is to say that where space is not curved because of the influence of nearby heavy objects like stars and planets. And so when they get out to a big flat space, they can warp, and that warp allows them to kind of enter something called Akukan, which is translated in our subtitles as subspace. And Akukan is not black, it's very bright. And And then they warp out back into normal space, and they've gone much farther than they would have otherwise. So...
But Noriko explaining this in her letter...
Yeah.
It's an interesting contrast to just what you would think of as, like, a friend writing a letter from camp.
Yeah.
But then she launches into this explanation, and it's another cool moment of, like, this is the world they live in.
Yeah.
And it's... completely normal for teenagers to be talking about this kind of thing.
Sure.
And they are, like, in a way, I mean, they are acting like they're at camp.
Yeah.
It's kind of the first part of this episode.
And the whole opening sequence is basically, like, it segues into, from the explanation of warp and subspace into a ghost story that young Freud is telling about how, like, you know, some people say that subspace is connected to the spirit world, and gets the, you know, girls all freaked out, and then Noriko has to go do a kimodameshi. Kimodameshi is translated in the subtitles as a dare. Kimodameshi is like a sort of a camp, kind of a camp tradition that you do on your, like, school trip or whatever. And kimodameshi literally means like test of liver. courage is stored in the liver, as we all know. And a kimodameshi is like a scary thing that you have to go do, like go walk in the scary woods and then come back or whatever. And in this case, it's, you know, go out of your bunk in while the ship is in subspace and everything's all dark and shut down, and like go tie a ribbon around, you know, the ladder, the top of the ladder and the mech hanger, and then come back, and so that you can, when we're all out again, we'll be able to see that you actually did it. Yeah.
But as she's getting ready to do this and all the girls are giggling in a circle, Amano is reading by herself again.
Yes, and she's reading something academic, but I didn't stop to look closely at what the title was, but Amano is always reading serious stuff, so she's reading something serious and not participating in these childish games, even though she is the same age as all of them. Like,
She is very mature, but I also read it a little bit as, like, she's also a little awkward. She doesn't know how to be stupid with people.
Yeah, like, no, she doesn't.
And it's clear that she, especially with the last episode, she came from a privileged upbringing.
Yeah, a lifetime of excelling has clearly led her not particularly well prepared to do, like, normal teen stuff.
And that's another difference with young Freud, who is the other prodigy pilot, but is also the life of the party.
Yeah, she has no problem. So that is an interesting observation. And so while Noriko is on her kimodameshi and really losing her shit, she's very scared. She runs into a handsome young man with very tall hair.
And he does look like a ghost at first.
He does, and she gets freaked out, and then he's like, oh, hey, are you out on a dare too? Well, let me take your thing up. And then he goes up and very chivalrously ties both of their ribbons around the ladder, and then...
He very chivalrously does it and dunks on her while he's doing
it. Yes, he does. It's like he teases her, but like in a good-natured, kind of flirty way.
He seems to be a little older.
Yeah, maybe he seems like maybe he's a couple years older than her.
But it's that sort of, I mean, I was a teenage girl. Like, it's attractive when a guy that you think is cute is patronizing you a little bit.
I mean, if you say so. So, yeah. Oh, also, I wanted to point out that the, like, making up spooky stories about subspace is, like, a delightful sort of little detail, but also it felt like very, somehow, like, goofy B-plot in a Star Trek The Next Generation, or maybe, like, a Star Trek Voyager episode. Like, I don't know, like, it's very, like, a, you know, Harry Kim gets really into subspace ghost stories, and then, like, you know... can't get to sleep or something, kind of. Molly has no idea what I'm talking about, but no, trust me, I'm right about this.
I'm sure you are.
So I thought that was kind of funny. It felt very Star Trek to me. Like, very Star Trek, like, wacky subplot episode.
They do find something scary in the hangar.
What's that?
That is that Coach is there.
Oh, yeah, and then Coach is there.
They get in trouble.
They get in trouble for being out of their quarters during subspace travel, during warp.
And they get put on some, like, what cleaning duty do
they get? They get put on the most amazing cleaning duty. They have to put on spacesuits and go, like, outside the spaceship. And the spacesuits are, like, these delightfully bulky, like, diving suit-looking things. And they have to polish the laser lenses on, like, the giant laser cannons on the side of the ship. Which is both very evocative and gives you a sense of this scale. Because, like, one laser lens is, like, you know, 20 or 30 feet wide. And they're out there in their spacesuits, like, literally spraying some kind of, like, window cleaner onto the lens and then polishing it. Which I thought was a delightful, like, piece of menial labor that is only done as punishment. It's not the way that the lenses would actually have to be cleaned.
Yeah.
And then also, like, really kind of hammers home the scale of the big weapons. Like, they're, like, two people, and they're, like, polishing the lens, like, this giant lens that's, like, one of a row of, like, you know, 50 on the side of the ship or whatever. It's a really nice moment of scale.
This is also where I noticed that Excellion is written in English on the on the side of the ship.
Ah, interesting.
But when the top brass,
yes,
is chilling out on the bridge,
yeah,
eating sushi and drinking tea,
eating sashimi,
their teapot says Excellion in katakana.
Which, like, if you've ever been, I mean, you know, if you've ever been aboard one of the handful of floating museums in the United States, where it's like a decommissioned warship that's been turned into a museum, and you can go in and
that is so much less romantic than what I want to think the word floating museum means.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. Although I think it's pretty, well, if not romantic, then cool.
We live in New York, obviously, and I am scared of the Intrepid. Like, I'm scared to look at it. It's just too big, and Paul thinks it's awesome.
We got to go to the Intrepid. Anyway, but, like, if you go to the Intrepid, like, they absolutely do have, like, for the officers, certainly for the executive officers, like, for special state occasions, entertaining dignitaries or whatever, they absolutely do have, like, fine china with, like, the name of the ship and stuff on it. So I thought that was a nice little reference or detail, I guess.
It's also interesting that it's a very multicultural ship.
Yes.
But this is, like, a really swanky Japanese meal.
Yeah.
That they're all having. And also the bridge looks like Nerve headquarters.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And, like, we're going to get into this later. There are a lot of parallels here, too, with Nadia of the Mysterious Seas, which was the TV series that Anno directed for NHK in 1991, or he directed a lot of it anyway. Mm-hmm. I think he did, right?
Yeah. Boy, I really hope Sadamoto did the character.
Yeah, Sadamoto did the character design. But, like, there a lot of this stuff gets revisited in Nadia, like, aesthetically.
And they are on their way to a star.
They're under, right? A star called Leaf 64, which the captain waxes poetic about how it's such a beautiful Earth-like star. You don't see many stars this young, which I don't know if it's astronomically true or not, but and he has, like, this whole soliloquy about how beautiful it is and how
it's
much
it's just beautiful.
It's like a paradise in space or something.
It's just a fresh, nubile star.
God.
He didn't.
But it does kind of.
He's weirdly horny for this.
Yes.
It's before they get there that something happens.
Yeah, then they have their first encounter with the enemy, and it's very in passing. Like, it doesn't lead to a battle immediately. But they do realize that the enemy is massing around Leaf 64, And so they're gonna confront it there and have their first like engagement with the space monsters.
Yeah.
During this time, this is when then we cut back to Noriko, and it turns out that she has another problem.
But first, that problem,
yes,
we get the really cute intra Excelion public transportation system.
Oh, I love it. Yes. And it's got like the little map, and
it's like the Japanese subway.
The overhead announcements, and it's like, next is the women's locker room. Next stop. And they even have like Joshikosho Mae. Like it just has this like the all of the stations have very like transit station like names. I don't know how else to describe it. It's just delightful. So there's the ship is big enough that it has its own like little mini subway system, and the subway system has an overhead announcer and straps that you hang from and a map, and it's delightful.
And Noriko is on her way to the women's locker room.
Yes.
And this is another little scene with her getting to know Smith. And she's studying really
well. Well, we don't know his name yet.
Oh, yeah. Getting to know the tall-haired gentleman. and Noriko's studying really hard for like the first half of this episode.
Which he teases her a little bit about.
Yeah, and he says like, oh, you're just acting like such a cute little freshman.
Yeah.
And she calls him patronizing.
Which he is.
He is, and she sticks her tongue out at him.
Yes. Then, but it's an interesting detail that this is the first time she gives an explanation for all of her studying, because we have seen her being really studious previously in this episode, and it's because she's fallen behind because of the time dilation from the previous episode. Like all of her classmates like continued in their training and graduated, and she essentially got thrown back into that class as they got assigned to the Excelion, but without any of the months of training. So she's like cramming essentially to try and catch up, which I thought was a nice detail. They acknowledged like, oh yeah, she missed a big chunk of time and now she's behind.
Oh, and before she gets off, she does have this really emotional moment where when he makes fun of her, she's like, well, I have to be the best because I'm the top team of the, what is it called? Is it like the top squadron? Is that what they're called?
Yes.
She's like, we're the best team in the top squadron, and you just can't understand the bond that I have with One-sama.
Yeah.
And before that becomes more of an issue in this episode, we have a nice cameo in the women's locker room from Lin Min Mei.
Yeah, it definitely looks like Lin Min Mei, the idol singer from the original Macross series.
It's, if you've never seen Macross, just Google image search Lin Min Mei, and she has a very particular, like, iconic hairstyle.
Yeah, her
that, like, no other character in anime has.
Yeah, so like, it's pretty clearly her, which is, I had never noticed before, and that's a great catch. Molly made that catch.
And this is another, you know, like, light fan service moment.
Yeah, although no actual, like, bared
no
breasts. Nips. Just lots of girls in their underwear in the locker room.
And Amano is talking to young Freud, and she looks over at Noriko, who is like changing her clothes with one hand and holding up her textbook with the other, which is very cute and earnest on one hand, right. But just like seeing this, you can tell it really strikes Amano that like, oh, she does not understand.
She is not ready.
What real space battle is.
Yeah.
Like, it's not conceptual.
Yeah.
And then Noriko sneaks into the hangar to, like, read her textbook and,
like, in the cockpit of her mech so that she can, like, you know, run the drills manually, like, you know, with all the stuff in front of her.
And so she overhears a conversation that she's not supposed to, which is that Coach is in the hangar, and Amano confronts him.
Again.
And says, look, like, you can't, what are you doing? She's seriously not ready to fight, and if you're gonna make her fight, then I dissolve my partnership with her. Right. I can't fight with her. And this is a really good mirror of episode one, which is also a conversation that Noriko overheard.
Right.
And it's after that conversation that she and Coach embark on their like regimen to make her train harder.
But right.
This is much sadder and much more serious.
Yeah.
It can't just be solved by like getting stronger for the sake of kind of passing a test.
Yeah.
Because Amano knows that the next thing could be a life or death situation.
Right, right.
And she, what do you think it is? Do you think she just really doesn't want to be responsible?
I mean, so Noriko sort of she starts overhearing this conversation and then her hand slips and she accidentally opens the cockpit of her mech, and then Coach and Amano see her there. And Amano sticks to her guns and is like, I'm sorry, but it's the truth and this is for your sake. And it's clear to me that like she's saying essentially that she's a liability. Like,
yeah,
she will get herself hurt and she will get the people around her hurt because she is not ready for combat piloting. And it's just a fact. And it's an unpleasant fact, but it's a fact. And she doesn't understand, she being Amano, does not understand why Coach is just like apparently fine with sending her out to battle.
Yeah. And this, I mean, Noriko's like heartbroken.
Right.
And that's another really important difference from episode one, because at this point, she, like, this relationship means so much to her.
Right.
This is her only friend from Japan. It's the only fellow student that she, you know, like found the Luxion with.
Right.
So it's the most important person in her life abandoning her. That's how she feels.
Yeah.
And during this confrontation, Amano is using Watakushi the whole time, I noticed.
Huh.
I don't know if I think she doesn't always use it.
You don't think
like,
so?
As her,
I haven't been paying attention.
I'm not sure, but yeah, she uses like the most
formal personal pronoun,
which isn't common. People don't use it much.
People don't use it very much. It's yet another gesture towards the idea that like we're meant to think of her as a very high class, coming from privilege, formal kind of person. TK, buddy, get out of there.
Our cat is really poking around. By the way, our cat is named after someone that I don't think is in this show.
I don't believe that Takahito Koyasu has a role in Gunbuster.
But that's who our cat is named after.
Yes, because he's so handsome.
Yeah. Oh, and then, Noriko kind of goes to lick her wounds.
And runs into the handsome tall-haired man again. Who says, you know, don't worry, I'll team up with you.
Also, the vending machine area is very multicultural.
It is. I love...
It's like a pizza machine.
I love... Man, our neighbors are just clomping around upstairs. New York City, baby! I love all the, like, hand-drawn signs on the wall that are, like, throw your garbage away and stuff behind them as they're having this conversation. And then, yes, the multicultural vending machine area. And... this guy says, don't worry about it. I'll team up with you and we'll go out together. And so you won't have to go out alone. And Noriko thanks him. And then finally, he's like, oh, by the way, my name is Smith Torin.
Take it away, Paul.
And I mean, I feel like almost everybody knows this already. It's like a famous piece of trivia. But like Smith Torin, the character, was named for Torin Smith, the real live person who was a major figure in the history of manga in English. He was basically a guy who discovered manga through science fiction and went to one of the early Daikons, which was like a big Japanese science fiction convention. Daikon famously is where the Gainax, back when it was an amateur, just a bunch of amateurs, debuted their like Gainax 3 and 4, I think. They did these big pastiche opening animations for the con proper. And that, like, that's what launched their history as a studio. And it was at DICON 5, I believe, that James P. Hogan, the science fiction author, was the guest of honor, and Torrance Smith was, like, a friend of his or something, and went along as his, like, assistant. And it was there that he essentially fell in love with manga and met, like, all of these really important people in the, in, like, the anime world, all, like, at that con. And it just put it, gave him a bunch of connections. And he eventually decided, fuck it. This is how I want to spend my life. So he just, like, sold all his shit and moved to Japan without much of a plan, being like, I want to bring manga over into English. And he did. He helped found Studio Proteus, which was the big manga translation adaptation studio. The first thing they licensed was Bubblegum Crisis. That was not a manga. Was Appleseed, the Appleseed manga from Masamune Shirow, which had just won the Seiyun Award, which is the award, like the Japanese version of the Hugo Award, basically. And, you know, he basically just, you know, lived in poverty in Japan for several years while he made connections and, you know, translated stuff.
So he's like the Saint Francis of manga.
I don't know who that is, but sure.
He's the poor saint that talks to birds.
Yes, sure. But he was like, he lived in a dormitory with a bunch of Gainax animators during part of this time. And which this would have been around the time that Gunbuster was being made. And so they named this character after him.
Was he like the same? Was he a peer of the Gainax crew? Or was he older?
No, he would have been about the same age.
Okay, because
yeah,
I was kind of imagining this like 40-year-old American man.
Yes,
with a bunch of 25-year-old.
No, he was pretty young then. And he was Torrance Smith was one of the names that you like heard in conventions. He was like a guy that had the job that I wanted when I discovered that manga was a thing. He was like sort of a personal inspiration to me, even though I never met him. And now I never will, because he died in 2014 and it was very sad. But he has a Gunbuster character named after him, which is pretty cool. So that's who Smith Torin is named after, Torrance Smith. So then what happens?
We said we weren't going to recap, but we're basically...
Oh, no, we're recapping with commentary. It's fine. Whatever. It's fine. I don't know why I said we weren't going to recap when we were obviously going to recap. Stupid.
So, and I never feel comfortable talking about, like, really sci-fi montages, because I feel like I always sound like an idiot when I do, even though this is, like, space mech is one of my favorite genres anything. Yeah,
I don't agree with this assessment of yours, but go on.
We have this control room bridge area that really looks like what they use at Nerve and Ava, and we have just like UX popping off everywhere.
Yeah, just
not
like
UX, UI.
Bunch of people sitting in like rows of chairs looking at consoles and big holographic displays being projected overhead.
But before this confrontation between Amano and Coach, there's like a little scene in the control room where they realize that their enemy has passed by them, and they're still heading to Leaf 64.
Right.
And they still don't have any reason to think that it's not what the captain thinks it is.
Right.
And they're prepping the ship like to travel there.
Yeah.
And there's kind of a like spaceship crew doing stuff.
Yeah.
Montage.
And we see all these mechanisms like engaging and...
Oh, and we see a bunch of little spaceships.
Yeah.
Hangar, and they all have like personalized graffiti on them, which is cute.
Yes.
But this whole scene has kind of a like a pleasant, bustling vibe, and the music is positive.
Yeah.
But the next scene where they are approaching Leaf 64, which is not what the captain thought it was going to be.
Right.
It is a red, angry, exploded star.
It's a red giant. So a red giant is like a star in the latter period of its life.
And this is weird because it like it's been a decade since it was this.
So Leaf 64 shouldn't star. You know shouldn't be a red giant for you know millions and millions of years. So it's very strange that it suddenly now turned into this red giant. The captain is like, "No, this ugly red giant! What happened to my beautiful Leaf 64? My beautiful nubile lissom star."
And they also realize that a whole, I don't know what the group name is, like swarm of space monsters is sort of coagulating at Leaf 64, and they're going to have to like launch an all out attack.
Right.
Kind of last minute. And the montage for getting ready for this attack like is not a happy bustling montage.
Yeah.
The music is very stressful.
Yes.
There was one thing especially I loved about this scene, because I think the show has so many brilliant little moments. They usually don't involve dialogue at all, but it's like really getting into Noriko's experience and like just how overwhelming it would be.
Yeah.
Cause they show the mech pilots lining up to launch. And I think at this point, Amano and Young Freud are partnering for this battle.
That's sort of the implication, yeah.
And they pull their awesome, like, ninja masks.
Oh, yeah, they're like pilot ninja masks. Yeah, those are very cool.
And so this is the exercise battle where, you know, Noriko and Smith just made this partnership, and now they're going to have a huge space battle with it. And, like, right before Noriko pulls up her mask, it's like you get the sense that you can almost see it on her face that she was sort of like giddy about working with him.
Yeah.
Up until this moment where she's like in line to be launched into a battle of space monsters, and then she's terrified. It's almost like it's like the face of someone going up a roller coaster.
Yeah.
And they kind of like they put off their fear until the last possible second.
Yeah. And then follows like a genuinely harrowing.
This is such a brilliant.
It's really brilliant, and it's not what you expect at all. They go out, and it's nearly all from Noriko's perspective. She goes out and immediately loses track of Smith, like visually. She doesn't know where he is, and she's like, "I can't see you." And he comes in over the radio and is like, "Don't worry, you know, I'm right below you," or something. And she looks down, and she still doesn't see him. She never sees him again. And he's like shouting out commands to her, like commands like, "I'm gonna be on offense, you'll be on defense, you know, we're gonna, you know, there's two approaching from above, get ready." And then these sort of dark blurs just kind of zoom past her at like, you know, impossible speed. She doesn't get a good look at him. We don't get a good look at them. Torrance Smith seems to like, you know, get a couple Smith seems to get a couple of like shots off or something.
And then like very quickly, tell me what this ship is. It's like the smaller ship that they launched.
Oh, the,
The Tardion,
yeah.
Which is written in Hiragana.
Yes.
That, is it like a,
it was like
what
the
kind of ship is
it? It was like the, I don't know, it's like a destroyer or a fast frigate or something. It's like the first, it's like one of the first ships to encounter the enemy.
And it very quickly just gets destroyed.
Right, it just gets destroyed. And it's not clear, like, you know, they lose contact with it. It seems like it might have been destroyed. It's not clear. And this whole battle sequence in general is very much a, Noriko seems to have no idea what's going on. There's a lot of radio chatter. She's completely like sensory overload. She doesn't know what's going on.
And, like, so are we.
Yeah, it's very confusing. She's out in, we see her mech, but she's like out in the middle of nowhere. There's nothing close by her. You know, Torrance Smith is supposed to be close, but we never see him. And then like she gets a few swipes, like near misses of aliens coming by her, but they don't hit her ship. Or her mech. And then after like one pass, Like Torrance Smith is like, oh, get in there, you know, get ready. They're coming in for another pass or whatever. And then there's another pass. And then she tries to radio him and there's just silence. And yeah. That's it. There's just silence. We don't see anything. We don't hear anything. And then she's just kind of like panicking. And then the battle ends when it turns out that when the captain realizes that this whole thing has been a diversion. Like they haven't even encountered the main fleet. And they recall the fighters and the mechs, and Noriko flies back. And we have this very sad sequence of her, like, it's deeply anticlimactic.
Yeah.
And then she's getting off. We see that hers is the only mech that didn't even like launch its bomb.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't take a single swing with her like spear. She didn't launch her missile. She didn't do anything. And Smith is Smith is obviously dead. Nobody even mentions it because like in the context of the battle, it's like a minor footnote. And that's just that.
And this is something that we had a conversation about, you know, like 2.5 years ago.
Yeah, when we first watched
the show together, that there's something that's extra devastating about how it's not like this isn't. I think this is like a brilliantly directed battle, but it's not like a cool action battle.
No, it's not an action. It's not even really an action sequence.
And so there's not like a big death scene. It just goes silent. She doesn't get to say goodbye to him. Like, his death happening is something that happens just as fast as the rest of the battle, where she can't even really register what's happening.
Yeah, and one gets the sense that, like, obviously this takes place over only a few minutes of time in the episode, but it's definitely implied that this battle did not take very long, you know, in real time at all. Yeah. Like, it seems like it was like they went out for, like, an hour and then came back.
Yeah.
Maybe even less than that. Like, it really is just a very short period of time. It was a very confusing encounter for everybody. It's not clear how many other... Like, we see damaged mechs, and clearly, like, they've taken some damage, and you know, the Tarzian has been destroyed, and maybe other ships, too. But, like, I thought that it really conveyed, like, the confusion of war really well. Yeah. Like... You know, and you go out into war and some people, you know, die pointlessly, and some people get in really pitched battles, and some people go out and a lot of stuff happens around them, and then they come back and it's like, I don't have a scratch on me and I have no idea why.
Yeah.
And it felt very, it's very upsetting. And then there are a few scenes that follow that where, like, she, you know, one of the ways we know that they weren't out there very long. She's after the battle, she's walking by the vending area, and like she sees like the drink container that he gave her after he whatever. It's just like still sitting there on the bench. Like it hasn't even been thrown away yet.
They didn't follow the sign.
It's just like been sitting there and like
please mention the ridiculous anime trope.
I'm gonna leave it to you.
Oh, so right when they decide to be partners and he walks away from the vending machine area, he gives her his soda that he was drinking, and Noriko takes a sip and then she's like, an indirect kiss, and then just like blushes up to her eyes, which is one of the silliest but really common anime tropes in like high school romances. But it's, you know, it's not like a lot of things in Gunbuster.
And an indirect kiss, to be clear, is like when you drink from from like a cup or like a straw at the same place that like, you know, your crush did. It's like, oh, it's like your lips touched the same place. So it's like an indirect kiss.
But like a lot of things in this show, it's really sad.
Yeah. When she sees that container again, it's like, oh, he's dead now. And then she's going back into the hangar. And like sees the ribbons that he tied up on the ladder, and I thought that it did such a good job of depicting, like the nonsensicalness that immediately follows someone's surprise, like, unexpected death. Like, all their shit is just there.
Yeah, and she's also, you know, wandering the halls of the ship at night, and she's not scared because she can't really register anything.
Yeah.
And she opens the door to the boys' dormitory on this trip, and no one speaks a word, but all the boys, you can tell that they, like, are or have just been crying, are in a very dark mood.
Yeah, she's walking the halls and, like, opens the door to the boys' dorm, and it's just, like, there's just, like, a couple seconds shot with hardly any animation, and we see, like, I don't know, 10 or 15 young men, and they're all just devastated. And it's so sad.
And it's also really gutting that, like, you know that she knows he's dead, and, like, she knows what she's gonna find when she opens that door. But it's like, I think we all know this. Like, part of the experience of grief is that you have that weird part of your brain that holds out for it just to not be true.
Yes, like, somehow I've misunderstood.
So, like, it's like, you know that tiny part of her brain is like, I'm just gonna go in the dorm.
Yeah.
And eventually she wanders in to find Coach in some sort of room.
It's not clear to me how she got to here, to this room. She also just
opens this door.
She just also opens this door, and there's Coach, like, in this room that has a window looking out onto some kind of big mecha head thing. Like, it's very large.
Looks nothing like their mechs that they fight.
It looks nothing like anything we've seen before in the show, really.
It's much more supernatural and kind of like living organism-ish. Yeah. It's not like these sort of like cute, clunky fighter mechs. But, you know, emotionally important for this episode, like, Noriko doesn't give a fuck.
She does not notice. She seemingly does not notice it at all.
She runs sobbing into Coach's arms. And I don't think he speaks a word in this scene, but she just says, you know, like, even if I can't fight with One-sama, like, I'll do whatever it takes. Just train me harder. Like, tell me what to do.
Yeah.
To be better. And I think at this point, like, not only does...
This feels like probably the lowest point emotionally for her in the entire series.
And you have to, I mean, compared to something like Eva, Gunbuster is such a short show.
It's six episodes.
We're halfway through
the whole show. This is halfway through the whole show.
And you have to think about, like, during these, at this point, just 60 minutes, Noriko has, like, been kind of isolated and bullied in high school with, like, accusations of nepotism.
Yeah.
She's gone to space and almost literally, like, seen her father's death.
Right.
And had to have this emotional experience in front of everyone.
Yeah.
And now she had to watch the person that she thought was her closest friend and most important relationship kind of, at least in her eyes, renounce her.
Right.
Then she loses her next partner, who's also, to her, like, her first love.
Yeah.
So she not only has all these feelings about not being good enough, but at this point, I think she also has a lot of survivor's guilt.
Right. She's not doing great.
No.
So she begs, you know, she says she'll do anything. Just give me training. I'll do whatever. I'll do anything. That's the end of the episode.
Not quite.
Except for then it cuts without any particular explanation or fanfare, it cuts to an exterior shot of the red giant star that Leaf 64 has turned into, and we see, like, this, like, colossal monster begin to emerge from it, as it sort of proves the theory stated earlier in the episode that perhaps the space monsters use stars as, like, hosts for their eggs. And this thing is very big and very scary.
And it just, it's sort of this, like, grotesque, like, flower bud.
Yeah.
That opens its mouth and roars.
Yeah, sort of screams.
And it's still so scary because in this episode, we saw the space monsters mostly as just these shapes that whiz by.
Right.
And even this is, like, not the whole thing.
No.
The closest we've seen to, like, the whole body of a space monster is, like, the preserved corpse.
Yeah.
And the Excelion.
And it's just this totally kind of inimical, implacable, incomprehensible force kind of just emerging from the inside of a star.
You keep calling the space monsters implacable.
Look, you can't plaque them.
But then, but my head is trying to make a jingle out of it. So I'm like, implacable edible egg.
My God.
I definitely remember that the first time I watched this episode, I thought I was very sad, but it didn't. It fucked me up more this time.
Yeah, I think so too.
All the ways that it was so tragic.
Upon a closer reading, it's like, it's very, very sad.
It's a really tragic war story, but so much of what's really heartbreaking in this show is that there's all these moments of young people just acting like young people.
Yeah.
Like trying to have a normal experience in the midst of this extraordinary setting. And I think some people might watch this and be like, how is your first love someone that you talked to three times?
Like, that's very easy.
Like, again, it's like camp.
Yeah.
And at camp, you make your best friend and your crush in a day.
Yeah.
And then you're in love with them for the next 2 weeks, like more than you've ever been in love with someone before. And it feels very much like that experience.
Yes.
And this is also, I've never thought of this until right this moment.
Go on.
Smith is like a Kaoru figure.
Really?
A little bit.
Do tell.
Okay, so I'm sorry that I keep bringing up Ava.
I mean, it's like, you know, the masterpiece of the guy who directed this, so I think it's a legitimate object of comparison.
So in Evangelion, Kaoru is a character that does not have much screen time, but he has an enormous impact on the main character. Because at a really low point in the main character's emotional life, this weird boy, who also has gray hair, shows up.
Huh.
And has this monologue that's just like, you're worthy of empathy.
Right.
And you can tell that, like, these are words that have, like, never been spoken to this character.
Right.
He's, like, the embodiment of unconditional love.
You can just say Shinji.
Shinji, Smith Torn is not like that because he's also kind of a jerk. But he has this role of like, he appears to Noriko in this moment where she's really scared at first.
Right.
And then he shows up again when she's just been like abandoned by the most important person in her life.
Right.
And it's just like this, like, you can be my partner, like this kindness, even if he doesn't realize it, is clearly monumental to her.
Yeah, he shows her kindness and care in a moment when she desperately needs it. TK, buddy, no, don't. All right, he's just.
This is definitely a landmark episode for our cat.
Yeah, he's being a real problem. It's fine.
And like Kaoru.
Yes.
His time is really short. And it's, you could see how like the other characters wouldn't understand that someone could have like such an impact in such a short time. But when someone says what you need to hear, like at your lowest moment, that can have a really profound effect.
Yeah. It really can.
I feel like that's what he was to Noriko.
Yeah.
So
one other thing I wanted to point out, that in the shot of, you know, this is the first time we see the gunbuster on screen, and the sort of the head that in behind Coach in that room where Noriko encounters him, it's very weird looking and intimidating and kind of different in than the other mechs. It's also not finished.
Yeah,
like there are parts missing from it. It's clearly incomplete, and that that coming between, like, before it, this battle that has gone very poorly for this force, And then after it, this like horrifying space monster being born. They've got this mech in here. Maybe it can do something. I mean, they'd have to finish it first. It really kind of hammers home that this is a completely desperate mission. Like, it seems very put together and the ship's complete and everybody's trained and whatever. But, like, clearly, humanity is not ready for this. And at some level, they are aware of this because they sent this battleship out containing, you know, the Gunbuster, which is not even done being assembled. And it's like, oh, no, things are very bad.
I don't know if this is just because we see so much of everything from Noriko's perspective. But, like, I don't know, like, even from, like, Amano and young Freud, you kind of get the sense that, like, the high school pilots that were selected for this ship were not told, like, how fucked humanity almost is at this point.
Yeah, you definitely get the sense that there's been some management of information that's gone on that is making it that is preventing most people from understanding the extent or the scale or consequences of the threat that they are facing.
This is sounding too much like exactly what's happening now.
Ugh. Well, that's not what we want to think about.
No, but we can.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of why Gunbuster is good.
Exactly.
Because it's a fanciful mech show that has real emotional weight.
And it's going to get even better.
Yeah.
And we'll be back in a few days.
With episode 4.
Also, just like I said, the ending song just gets more absurd by every episode.
It was pretty rough for this one. It's very bouncy and the feelings are not so bouncy.
But we'll see everyone next time.
Yes, we will.